I have one announcement about next week. We will have to skip next week's Tuesday lecture because I have to go on to a business trip. So next week we will only have the lecture on Thursday, only disappointment. Yeah, hopefully not disappointment. Good. So, welcome back to Interventional Medical Image Processing. And what I would like to do today is discuss a bit scatter, scatter correction, scatter estimation, and later on a very fast algorithm for scatter correction and image processing. And what I essentially want to show today is that you can simplify a model if you have certain assumptions that you place into that model. And by simplification, you can reduce the amount of complexity in the correction and the necessary correction steps considerably. But of course, the accuracy of your correction or of your estimation may be reduced. But if you are working towards a particular task, it may be valid to do these assumptions and to sacrifice accuracy in order to get an improved image quality. And so I like this example because it shows on the one hand that when you're working with an imaging device, or if you work with an image, the image processing most of the time, or this, so you solve your image processing problems with image processing methods. But of course, all the image processing that you do is also related to the imaging modality itself. And if you want to process an image, it's good to have a feeling of the underlying physics. So we will have some physical equations in this class today, but I don't want to emphasize too much on the physics. And also, concerning this point, this is more about that it's good to have an understanding of the physics, but this is not a physics class, and none of you is required to have deep, in-depth knowledge about physics. But if you have a feeling what's happening, then you can design much better algorithms and get a feeling for much more efficient algorithms. And we will do that by looking at a couple of examples, and the example that I'm putting in here is scatter correction. So what I want to convey in the class today is that if you have a feeling how stuff works, then you can adopt your image processing methods in a way that you can actually use them more efficiently. There's guys out there who don't care about the actual formation of the image. They just apply image processing and they say an image is an image is an image. So it's always the same thing. But if you understand how your imaging modality works, it's always a pro. Yeah? But of course, this is not a physics class. Okay, so let's talk a bit about the effect of scatter. And in principle, when we're talking about scatter, we are often, so this example is related to X-ray imaging. And when you do X-ray imaging, you typically have the constellation that you have some kind of X-ray tube that is positioned here, and then you have your patient. So this is the general setup. If you attended diagnostic medical image processing, you already know this graph, yeah? And then you have an X-ray detector here. So this is generally how it works. And what you do is you shoot an X-ray through your patient, yeah? Through your object. Often we call this patient then F of XY. Yeah? So this is generally the name of our patients. They're called F of XY. And then we measure the intensity here at our detector. And generally what you measure here is photons. And when you measure here, you measure some intensity I. And this I in a physical model that also incorporates scatter is composed of two sources. So on the one hand, it's the primary photons, it's IP, because these are the photons that arrive here directly. And then it's composed of a secondary intensity, and this is called IS. and IS is the scattered intensity, and this is caused by some different X-ray that is maybe shot here, and then there is some scattering event, and it arrives at the very same detector cell. So this guy here is then the scattered intensity, and this guy here is the primary intensity. And what you measure at the detector is generally the sum of both. And your detector pixel can't differentiate between the scattered intensity and the primary intensity, because, well, there's countermeasures to reduce the scatter. We will look at a couple of them also today. But generally, what you measure is a sum of the primary. This is actually what you want to measure. Yeah? You want to measure the primary signal. And also, if you go into reconstruction later, you want to reconstruct only the direct rays. The scattered rays are causing some additional signal. So maybe they're even good for the photon statistics and can even help you with the image noise. But in general, you don't know where the scatter signal is coming from. And if you want to actually figure out where your scatter signal is coming from, what you typically have to do, if you can have different models. And this is scatter estimation. And this is what the first set of slides that I want to show to you is about. So this is scatter estimation. And later, when we do scatter correction, we are actually interested in how to get an estimate of the scatter. And the scatter correction itself is then just the subtraction of the scatter signal from the measured signal. And then you get back the primary signal. So you're corrected signal. So an estimate of the correction would then be just the measured intensity, if this is the measured intensity, and then you subtract your scattered intensity and you get the scattered corrected intensity. So this is more or less what we want to do. So we want to perform scatter correction. And now we will see that there is many different ways in estimating this scatter. And this ranges from very complex models, and we'll start with the most complex model. And this is using a lot of physical knowledge to even more simpler models, to simpler and simpler models. And we will see how this affects our scatter estimation. Okay. Good. So this is why we need scatter estimation. The two sets of slides that I'm going to show, actually it's three sets of slides, they are based on two papers in medical physics. So this is, you see, the already the journal is called Medical Physics. So this is a lot in relation with physics. And it's written by Ernst-Peter Rührenschopf and Klaus Klingbeck, two colleagues that have been working in the area here. And they have written essentially a very good and a very complete paper on scatter estimation and correction approaches. And because they had so much to say, they put it in two papers. So there's part one, scatter compensation, and part two, scatter estimation. But we start with part two now, because we first look into the scatter estimation, then we briefly go through part one, but we don't want to spend too much time on part one, because I don't think it is, for the kind of information that I want to convey, it's not too relevant today. But it's a very good paper, so I can really recommend to look at those two papers. They're also a very good read. So how can we actually measure scatter? How can we get the information? Where is the scattered signal coming from? So this is already one task. How can you? So of course, we can take some kind of physical model. But the physical model is, of course, based on some kind of measurement. And first, we will look into different measurement scatter estimation approaches and give a short overview on that. Then we will look at a system theoretic framework and talk about a bit how we can actually create a more efficient way of describing the scatter model. And we will boil this down then to a projection-based scatter model. And then we will shortly discuss image-based, iterative hybrid heuristic approaches. We will not go into too much detail here. But Let's first start with the measurement-based approaches. So what can you do in order to measure scatter? Well, you can use a collimator. So how can we measure scatter? We always measure the primary and the secondary. How can we measure scatter? What could we do? The solution is already there, but what the general idea that we can use, it's a very simple one. So if our measured signal is the primary plus the scattered, what could we do in order to measure the scatter? We can then, yeah? Yes, you set the primary to zero, and how do we do that?
Yes.
Essentially, that's exactly what we are doing. So, you can do that in two kinds of ways. So you could either build the detector larger, that you also image area that is not directly irradiated. So you could, for example, apply collimation. So you put a collimator in here, and then this area and this area will only be irradiated by scatter. Yeah.
Doesn't that make a very strong assumption that the scattering is isotropic?
Well, it will tell you the difference in a very local area. Okay. So because you can essentially say, if you have an assumption that your object doesn't have too high geometric frequencies, so let's say your object is in this area, so this is the boundary, and what you say is, well, the object is more or less the same here and here. And then you say, this is the side without scatter, and the other side is the side with scatter. Or what you can do, you can also block stuff here. So you put in some lead pieces in front of your detector and stop the beam. And this is exactly what the beam absorber array or beam stop is. And what I just showed you is the collimator continuation. And then so there's also a nice technique based with the idea of primary modulation. Well, this is how you can. So if you assume you have a more or less constant object, then you can get a scatter estimate by putting in a lead collimator. So this is lead. So 2 millimeters of lead will usually block the entire X-ray. And you put it in front of the object. Then you get your primary plus scatter in the gray area here. And in the dark gray area, you only get the scatter, because this is where no primary beam can reach the detector. So here in this area, you measure the scatter. You measure the scatter here. And then you can either only measure the difference between scatter and primary at this point, or at this point, or you make the assumption that your object is constant over the entire detector space, and then you do this with a constant value. And it turns out this constant value assumption, if you are working in reconstruction problems, it's not half bad. So a lot of the scattered signal is actually of very low frequency. And a constant signal is, of course, just a zero frequency. But a scatter generally is very low frequency. Sometimes you have high frequency parts that are caused by bones, so there may be also some more high frequency patterns. But most of the signal is low frequency. And if you say, well, this is not a very good assumption, you can improve this. And what you do is you do a beam absorber array. So you place some kind of grid in front of your detector, or in front of the, you can even place it in front of the object. Then you will even stop this the radiation from penetrating the object or patient. And then you can do the same trick here. So you can measure your scatter again in these. So this actually simulates a lot of collimators. So you have a lot of pieces of lead that will stop the beam. And in the shadow of the beam stop, you will be able to measure the scattered signal. So this is how you can directly measure scatter. And with this, if you have an ellipse like this one, you can be very safely be sure that this is a correct scatter estimate. And then you can interpolate in between, and you will get a scatter estimate. So you can do things like this. What we have additionally here is you can use primary modulation. This is also a very interesting concept. So in primary modulation, you are not doing a complete stop of the signal, but you do filtration, because so you add in a filter, and this means that this filter, so you put in a filter, and this filter has a very, very fine checkerboard pattern. Yeah? So you put in something which looks like this. So you can either do it in stripes. So you put in a high frequency filter. And you could also design it as a kind of checkerboard pattern. Okay? And what you do now, so you have to complete the checkerboard here, okay? And now I created everything that goes through this kind of filter will have a very high frequency, because it must contain this frequency, it must contain the checkerboard pattern. And now what I do is, I take this kind of filter and I place this filter at some point here. Maybe I place it even here. And now I know if this kind of filter, this checkerboard filter, is preserved, then I have something which had a direct connection. Yeah? So if this pattern is preserved in my image, the part that is explained by that fulfills this must have been direct irradiation, and the scattered signal is not affected by this filter, so it's scattered somewhere here, so it is not primarily modulated, and this allows you then to do, so this is how you would place the primary modulator, so you place it before the object, this means that all primary rays will have the primary modulation, and the signal that is not affected by primary modulation must have been constructed by scatter within the object. And what you do then is you do a frequency analysis. And what you would have in the regular case, you would have the low frequency part here. And of course, your object also has low frequencies. But because you introduced the primary modulator, your frequency space suddenly looks like this, because your primary radiation has been modulated. This means that your object does no longer have low frequencies. Because of the modulator, it must have high frequencies. So because of the modulator pattern, the object is suddenly in this part of frequency space, so it has a lot of high frequencies, and your low frequency part is only created from the scatter. And then you can do scatter correction by removing the low frequency part here, and then comes the small downside of this method. Then you have an image that is no longer corrupted by scatter, but you still have the primary modulator pattern in there. So what you still need to do is you need to remove the primary pattern, but you know very accurately how it looks like, and this is why you can then remove the effect of your pattern as well. Yes?
One thing I don't get about this method, is it meant to be done for every image?
So yes, every time yes. Yes, yes, yes. You put this pattern always into the beam, and you get your scatter measurement for free with every projection. Interesting method. This method has been applied in tabletop systems, but it has not been done on clinical systems so far. And one reason is the clinical systems that have a lot of scatter problems are typically C-arm systems, and the C-arm systems also have the slight problem that by rotation the tube is more heavy than the detector, and this means that if you rotate, the projection geometry will change. And this means that the projection of the modulator pattern changes, and this causes you some trouble in removing the primary modulator pattern from your original signal. So if you have everything in a nice fixed geometry, then this works. But if you have motion in between, the problem, the correction is much more difficult. Okay, yes?
Well, but if we put this scatter, uh,
front of the line.
Then, yeah.
Don't we lose basically a lot, well, like part of the radiation?
Yes.
Could actually bring us some diagnostic information.
Well, there is effects on noise, definitely. There is effects on noise. Because what will happen is you have more attenuation in the parts where the checkerboard is present than in the other parts, which means that the noise properties will change. And then you have different noise properties depending whether there was a checkerboard pattern available or not. So there is a relation to noise and signal to noise, yes. But generally, you have this relation. If you do scatter correction, you typically also increase the noise. Because what you do here is, in general, your scatter correction will have rather low frequencies. And if you subtract a low frequency signal from another signal, you will implicitly increase the high frequencies. So generally, if you work with scatter correction, you have to be very careful with noise. And most scatter correction methods amplify noise. This is true, yes. And you should keep that in mind. This is also true for the method that we will look at in the end. It will also have the effect of amplifying noise. Good. So we can actually measure the scatter, but we in some systems we have trouble with this primary modulator. Of course, we have trouble with the beam stop arrays. So imagine if you put beam stops in there, you always have black dots in your projection image. So this is good if you're interested in scatter measurement, but if you have that in a clinical system, you probably don't want to do that because you lose information that you would be using for diagnostics. And with the collimator, well, this may be applicable, but this is of course only applicable in projections where you actually have the collimator present. Yeah, so this is also kind of limited where we can actually apply this. So we can do stuff very correctly, but we also have to keep in mind what is feasible in a kind of clinical sense. And you don't want to have black spots in your projections. Okay, so let's talk a bit before I go to the system theoretic framework. I would like to start with a bit of examples. And we had a very good bachelor thesis. And what was done in the bachelor thesis is we had a short Monte Carlo simulation. So one way of getting your scatter signal is by simulation. And what do you do? Do you guys know what a Monte Carlo simulation is? Yes? What's that? What do I do?
It was some kind of randomized approach. You throw in some random data and then you look at the outcomes and you hope.
Yeah, so it's a method for estimating integrals. And what we're essentially doing is an integral, because what we are measuring here, this intensity, is the integral over all the photons that arrive at the detector pixel. So this is a kind of integral that we're estimating here. And what you do in Monte Carlo is you trace every single photon through your object. And what you do is you start with, let's say, a billion photons. So typically, for one X-ray projection, you measure about a billion photons. So you probably want to simulate, if you narrow it down only to photons that will actually pass the collimator and that will only go into the direction of the image, you may be okay with 10 to the power of 8 or 10 to the power of 9 photons that you need to simulate. And then you have a billion photons that you need to send to your object. And what you do is you start the photon and you follow the ray, and then you have some kind of interaction. And you follow the ray to the next interaction, and you follow the ray to the next interaction. And then you compute the up to the point where the photon is absorbed. And of course, there's photons that are entirely absorbed, so they will just stop here and their entire energy is deposited. And until you get your image, you until you get a decent image, you typically have to model something like 10 to the power of 9 photons. So I can't do that right here. So what I will show you here is I will show you 10,000. So I will show you 10 to the power of 4 photons, because I didn't bring my cluster. So we will just work with 10 to the power of 4 for this simulation. And let's show you a box. And now I put vacuum at the background medium. And what you will see if I... So this is the... I get two things from the simulation. This is my projection image. Can you see this projection image? Can you see that I have simulated 10,000 photons? And I think the maximum value here... So you can see my 10,000 photons that were actually measured. This is a pretty sparse image. The scaling is not very good. But this is actually where my photons hit the detector. Can you see the object? Who can see the object? Yes? So I told you it's a box. Yeah. Oh, okay. You don't see anything here. Okay. I try to, but I don't think I can even more increase the contrast. Can you see this snow white noise here? So this is what happens if you do a low dose projection. Then you get this kind of image. Okay, so this is the kind of image that you get from 10,000 photons. But what's more interesting is probably this, because this is the plot of the photons that were actually generated. And this is the tube. The blue spot here is the tube. And they were sent to the object. This is my box. And this is the detector. And here I chose to visualize it more bigger. And you can see that if you look at the interactions from the source direction, you can see that this box here absorbs quite a bit of photons, and you can see that the shadow is actually the measurement that you get. And the red dots here are the final interactions where the photon was actually absorbed. And what you can see here is, of course, if I irradiate from here, I get a signal loss in my object, and the rest is measured here at the detector. And this is where the signal was stopped. This is now vacuum as the background medium. So if I play with this a bit, and I will give you a different background medium. So typically, it's not so a good idea to place your patient in vacuum, because for some reason the patients don't tolerate that usually. So let's try something different. Let's try air. And if we put in air, you will see our projection still looks very much the same. So you see a couple of black and white dots. But what you immediately see in the simulation, and I hope you can you see that? Yeah. So you can see that also the air absorbs photons. So there's interaction in air suddenly happening. And you can very clearly see the cone that is generated from your X-ray source. And here this is created from collimation. So you only have the only rays that actually are aimed at the detector are computed here. But you can also see that, maybe very faint, that there is some interactions also happening around here. So actually, this is centered around the object. There's also stuff happening here. And we can now even take a different background medium. And let's say we place the entire thing in water. And what will happen now is, so I have a very black screen. What happened here? Did I crash the system? This is strange. Okay, so what happens here is that actually none of the, and this is very small. So let's see if we can get the update again. So here is where your source is. And now not a single photon has arrived at the detector, because they're all absorbed right in front of the tube and they're scattered a lot. So if you do X-ray imaging in water, You need to use more energy. Okay. Good. Let's stop this guy here. Let's do something else. Let's do this for some more time. So I put on infinite simulation, and now let's go back to vacuum. So now we take the box and we take vacuum as background medium, and now we have a kind of real-time simulation. And let's also adjust the window level here. And now you can see that if I use many more photons, then you will start seeing that this box shadow starts to appear. So I have to use a lot of more photons until I get a kind of reasonable image. Yeah? And now you see mostly the background appears because this is the part that is directly irradiated. And you see very little interaction here actually in the object itself. So because for that you need an X-ray that penetrates the entire object and hits the detector. Now you can hear also that my computer is getting warmer because he's doing a lot of computations. And now while we were talking, we were already simulating 10 million rays, 10 million photons that have been sent to the detector, and I still have this very crappy image. Yeah? So you need a lot of photons to get a decent X-ray image. Okay. Very well. One thing that might be interesting, again, if we look at the case where we are simulating this detector projection again, one thing that is maybe interesting, where we have our integral, is if you look at this 3D visualization, and now let's look from this side here. This is where we are looking at the tube. What I measure here at the detector, this is what I also said earlier, this is a kind of integral. It's the integral of all photons that have actually reached the detector plane. So we are measuring a kind of integral here. And of course, now it's very complex to actually simulate every photon. So you need a lot of time, a lot of computation time to do these kind of simulations. So for that reason, you could start by simplifying the model and not say, let's simulate every single photon, but let's simulate the average effect that is happening at one voxel. And what you will have on average is you will have a certain kind of distribution. And this depends on the source position and the orientation of your ray. But what you will get on average is if you assume that you have a signal that has already arrived at a certain point, and this is your input, so this is your input signal, this is the primary fluence that has arrived at your pixel, then you typically get an average effect that will blur. So this is just a central peak. So this is just a single point. So if I put a profile through here, the profile looks like this. Yeah? And what typically happens is you get some characteristic scattering, and you typically have, so it can be either uniform, so you have scattering to all. This is dependent on the kind of material and the energy of your photon. And dependent on the kind of energy of your photon, you can get a uniform scatter, or you can even get a scatter that is mostly directed into a forward direction, or you can get scatter that is more or less looking like this. This is more towards the ray direction. So you have different kinds of distributions that can be achieved by the scattering of the signal on average. And you can compute this shape with the Klein-Nishina formula. I didn't put it in here, but this is how you could get such a characteristic. And this is dependent on your ray orientation. So your ray is coming from this direction. And of course, this is 3D. So I can write this into a system theoretic framework. And what it does is, it essentially is an integral. And now we have to think about what will we measure. Well, what we will measure is the effect of some kind of integral. Beep, beep. Who's beeping? We will measure some kind of integral, and this integral is essentially our IS. This is our scattered intensity. This is our I. This is the entire I. It's the primary plus the scatter signal. So we can compute this kind of integral, and we do that by using two kinds of information. One information is we need to know how much fluence, so how many photons will actually arrive at that voxel. And then we need to know in which direction will those photons be propagated. So this is more or less this. And this is a kind of, well, you can imagine it as a kind of 3D convolution. Yeah? So you have some signal, and dependent on your voxel position, well, it's not a convolution because it's different at every voxel. So it's not directly a convolution, but if you refer to the, so it's not a linear system, but at every voxel you have some kind of weighted sum that you can compute in order to estimate the scatter propagation. And if you do that, you can create at every voxel, you have to estimate how much intensity will appear at this point, how much intensity will arrive at this point, and then you multiply it with a propagation kernel and you integrate. And now this integration is over some variable t. And this variable t, so usually you would use a vector x or a vector u, depending whether it's a 3D coordinate system. So if you have a 3D integral, you would use an integration over the entire volume for the single pixel. So every voxel in the volume, because it's scattering, can contribute to every pixel at the detector. So there is a chance that for the given geometry, the entire volume can contribute to the single pixel. And what you do is you model the entire scattering process on average with such a kind of model. You can also, so we put T in here because you can use the same kind of formulation if you only consider the detector plane. So what we have here now is a general formulation, and you can write it down into a 3D space. If you consider f as an integral of a 3 dimension and t as a 3D variable, that are the three spatial coordinates of your volume, or you can then later use it as a projection-based model that will only integrate over a 2D domain. We will then see how we can actually get to this 2D projection-based model. And then you only have a 2D integration. So our k is the probability of the scatter source, of what goes in, to be detected at the element u. So this is essentially the direction that you're propagating to. And this is the continuous equivalent to a system matrix or discrete linear systems. And this is, of course, highly dependent on your acquisition, dependent on how much air you have, so how far the source is away from the detector, on the object density, because you have different materials at different voxels, and they have different density. It's dependent on the X-ray spectrum, because the scattering is dependent on the photon energy. It's dependent on beam filters, and then you can use stuff like anti-scatter grids, and this, all of this can be modeled in this variable kf of tu. So this is the scatter contribution. If we stay in the 3D case, this is the scatter contribution from voxel x to the detector element u. And t here, this t, is the primary fluence. So this is how much primary signal you actually get at the voxel x. Dependent on your source detector position, there may be attenuation before you reach this this point. So you have a different primary signal at every point in your volume. And dependent on your primary signal and the scatter direction, which is essentially given by Kf, you get a different scattering signal at your detector u. And now we can if you do a 3D kind of a model, then our primary term here will be given by the primary fluence. So this is the amount of photons that actually reach the voxel x, and mu s. And mu s is the amount of scattering, the amount of energy that will be converted into scatter at the voxel x. This means if we only consider the scattering term here, this entire integral will of course only give us the scattered signal. Yeah. And this also depends on, so this is only the amount of energy that is converted into scatter. And this is the linear scatter attenuation coefficient. And this is nothing else but a measure of probability of converting a photon into scatter at that particular voxel element. Good. So then according to this paper, and this is actually a very good thing, if you don't want to do Monte Carlo, you can essentially go down to two types of modeling. And what we have in the 3D case is a point scatter kernel. So this is the scatter kernel that is happening at every voxel in the volume. Or you can go down to a beam scatter kernel, and then you get a scattering model that is valid for an entire beam through the entire object. And this is the projection case. And we will shortly discuss the difference between the two. So if you have, so one way of estimating those scatter kernels for the 3D case would be to do Monte Carlo simulations and then to relate the actual measurement point to the volume point where the scatter event was taken. So this is one way of how you can estimate such scatter kernels. And this is directly volume to projection pixel. So this is the measured scatter signal then at the detector, and you have to integrate over the entire volume. Now you can also go, so this is then the final scatter model that will emerge from this. So you have the scattered intensity, a three-dimensional integral, and this integrates over the entire volume and sums up the amount of scatter that is converted from the primary fluence at the voxel x and multiplies it with the contribution that is done from this voxel to the specific detector point. So you have to, this is essentially an average value of how the two are connected. And of course, this is all object dependent. If you have a different object, you will have a different kind of scatter measurement that you can get with this kind of model. Yeah? Well, we have a 3D integral here that we have to compute for every single pixel on the detector. So for every pixel on the detector, we have to compute this 3D integral. So this is computationally quite inefficient. If you want to do that in a real-time application, you pretty much have a problem to compute that. And remember, you need an object model for this. So you essentially have to have a 3D model of your object that you're able to evaluate this kind of model. So if you don't know the actual composition of your model, what material and what density of that material is at every point in space, you can't evaluate this model. So if you want to do that, you first of all have to compute a 3D integral for every pixel, and you have to have a complete object model where you know the material and the density at every voxel of the point. Typically in an interventional environment, you don't have that. Then you can go down to beam scatter kernels, and essentially a beam scatter kernel is the integral of this thing here. So you evaluate the integral along your ray. So you can boil down one dimension because you say, I'm measuring the integral along the ray anyway, yes? Yes. But you take the average. So you take the average attenuation that will happen on the way to this voxel. And you can determine this by a ray casting approach. So you just deduct the photons that will have been absorbed on average until you reach this point. So again, you're using with expected values. Yeah. So with beam scatter kernels, you boil the entire problem down to 2D. And then you have a beam scatter kernel. So you have a different scatter kernel at every point on the projection. And this essentially tells you the influence of all other pixels on the projection onto this one pixel. And this is, again, you can determine it, for example, with Monte Carlo or measurement to estimate this kernel. And here, this problem then boils down that you say, well, I'm integrating, and you can actually show that if you integrate along this direction, then you only end up with a 2D integral. And this 2D integral is then dependent. So you have to integrate along this beam, the beam of U. You integrate over the beam of U. And then you can get the kind of scattering information that is only dependent on detector pixels anymore. And well, you can show that, and you can place it in here. And what you will get is some kind of beam scatter kernel that we can now denote as H. And now we only have a 2D integral. And we have the effect that every pixel in the projection may have a scatter contribution to every other pixel. And this is now dependent, so we can model the same thing with this general framework, but this is now again dependent on the object. And it is very crucial information is that you have to know, along every ray, you have to know the material composition. So you have to know how many millimeters of water has this ray passed, how many millimeters of bone, how many millimeters of air, and so on, if you want to determine this ray. But it's somewhat simpler. It's only a 2D integral, but it's still complex because you have to know the different amounts of material if you want to determine this beam scatter kernel. And then you can simplify this, and you end up with the same kind of equation as in our general framework. But this is now only a 2D integral. And now you can even simplify this more, and I have to check. Do we simplify this more? Yeah, so we can even simplify this more. So now we have an integral that where we have to multiply the primary fluence at every detector pixel with some kind of scatter kernel that may be dependent, that may be different at every point in the projection. So every point in the projection has a different kind of scattering kernel, because at every point in the projection you have a different influence of the other pixels to this certain pixel. This is not very cool. But so we still would have to evaluate this kind of integral, and we need to know how the material composition of the object is looking like. But we can then further simplify this. So let's simplify this further, and let's say, well, most of the time, most of our object is water. Patients are more or less water. There's some bone, but there's not too much bone. Most of the time it's water. And if it's bone, maybe we can model the bone as thick water. So maybe bone can be modeled just as water that is twice as dense as a normal water. Then we have a simplification. And now we have only a contribution. And this water equivalent thickness, by the way, this is something we can estimate directly from the projection image. Because what we measure is some kind of attenuation, and we get some line integral. And if we assume everything on the ray is water, we can get this water equivalent thickness. So at every point in the projection, I can compute a number, and I can say we would have obtained this measurement if I had had an object that were 43 centimeters of water. And if there's bone, the object just gets bigger. I suddenly have a thicker object, I suddenly have 80 centimeters of water because there was some bone in there. But generally, we can assume so this is simplification, of course, this does not match the physical reality, but we can assume, let's say, everything behaves like water. Then we still have a spatially variant system. because at every pixel I have a different water equivalent thickness, because at every pixel I have a different attenuation. But now I know, well, my object and the scatter that I'm trying to estimate, this is low frequency anyway. And you can further simplify this, and you say, let's get rid of the, or let's say, yes, we have a water equivalent thickness, but most of the time my patient has a diameter of 40 centimeters. Most of the time the patients are 40 centimeters in thickness. And then you say, okay, then I have a uniform. So, and this is, you really have to think about the application here. So if you are talking about a cardiac surgery and you're doing 2D imaging, what you're doing is you have a certain angulation, and then you're irradiating only the heart. You're only irradiating this part. Yeah? And then if you imagine this as a, let's look at this kind of slice volume, then you will see, well, this is the kind of area that I'm irradiating. And if I say now, well, on average, I can even estimate this average. Yeah? But I can average over the entire intensity and then estimate, well, this is about 42 centimeters of water. And then I suddenly have a model where I have the same water equivalent thickness, so the same amount of water at every point. And if you do that, you have a multiplication with something that is the same at every point, so at every pixel. And this entire 2D integral boils down to a 2D convolution, because we're suddenly we are shift invariant, and we have a weighted sum, and you can model this with a convolution. And then you're very fast, and then you can do real-time scatter correction. So you have to know what kind of scattering model you're using, and of course you have to know what kind of application you're doing. And if you're doing 2D imaging, and if you have more or less an object that has about the same thickness over your view, then you can suddenly boil this down to a convolution model. And then you have a convolution with a very large kernel, and you suddenly only have a convolution, and you can do that very efficiently. And the final estimation algorithm that emerges from this is then this real-time scatter correction process. And here is again the how you would scatter. And well, this is, by the way, the concept of an anti-scatter grid. So you can prevent scatter if you put small kind of lead pieces that are oriented towards the tube in front of your detector. So these are very small lead pieces or highly absorbing material, and you orient it towards the tube, and this will prevent scatter from being measured at the detector. So this is what we call an anti-scatter grid. And if you do that, you reduce the amount of scatter, but you also reduce, you slightly reduce the amount of primary, because some rays, of course, will hit your lamella, and this will also slightly reduce the primary. But in general, you can then do a scatter correction, and this may be the signal that you have acquired. And then you do this low-pass filter, because what remains from your scatter correction is suddenly only a low-pass filter. And your scatter estimate is then just a low-pass filter with a huge kernel. And you can get this kind of scatter signal. So this is your scatter signal estimate. And then you just subtract your scatter from the original image, and you get this guy here. And this is your scatter corrected signal. And you can see that you can, if you look at the contrasts here, and if you look at the contrasts here, you can see that you can see the small white dots here much better than in this image. So you have a much better contrast here. Yes?
Am I right that this now is not dependent on the patient with the X-ray, or you just say it's a cube of water, so you can do it beforehand? Or do you have to
Well, you can adapt the kernel size depending on your patient. So you may have thicker and thinner patients, and then your patient, so you get a different kernel for a different patient. So you don't assume he's 42 centimeters in diameter. So let's say you have a patient that looks like this. then you would even take a different model whether you're irradiating along this or along this direction. So you can switch the kernel dependent on the average attenuation in your image.
Yes, but I could pre-compute 100 kernels.
Yes, this is what you do in practice. In practice, you will say, okay, what are typical patient sizes? Typical patient sizes are, let's say, 60 centimeter to, let's say, 32. And then you say, in this area, we have 10 different kernels. And then you can just apply them. Yeah. And you get a very fast correction. By the way, do you know a method that applies a low pass and subtracts it from the original image? How is that called? Yes, it's unsharp masking. So you can use unsharp masking as a kind of scatter correction. So what remains in the end is unsharp masking, and this is very fast, and there is a kind of physical motivation to it. Okay, so this was to show you if you can start with the complex physical model, you can look into the scatter correction, then you realize it takes way too much time to compute. Then you start simplifying, and of course, you don't have to end up with this solution every time. So let's say you have a faster computer and you have nicer measurements. So let's say you have a special kind of detector that could differentiate between different materials, then you wouldn't use this model, because then you know if I could differentiate between water and bone, I could suddenly go back to my beam scatter model, and I could use some kind of bilateral filtering combined with this. So we'll look into a bilateral filter later anyway. There's where you have shift variant filtering. So I could combine this kind of model with a shift variant filtering, and then we suddenly have a more sophisticated scatter correction that we can still compute on a graphics card, for example. It's still real time. So we can now adopt our algorithm and the complexity of our algorithm onto the computing hardware that we have, and we can make it as good as possible for the given purpose. And you will realize that if your purpose is detecting those dots here on the image, then this kind of scatter correction method is already pretty good. If your purpose is a different one, it may be not so good. But for this particular task, we can see by this example that it's not a very bad method. And you can see the effect here, where the scatter correction has been applied, and the left upper part is uncorrected image, and the right lower part is corrected. And this method is called dynamic density optimization. Yeah. So if you make a product, so you design a nice method, then you go to marketing and you tell the marketing guy, oh, I have this very nice method. And you know, I boiled down my 3D scatter kernels to beam scatter kernels. Then I adjusted the water equivalent thickness to be uniform. And I got this very nice convolution-based method. And the marketing guy looks at you and says, oh, this is very nice. So you do something else and it's density related. Oh, let's call it dynamic density optimization. This is what we can tell to our customers. And then you have a leaflet and it says they're using dynamic density optimization. Then you put that into your commercials. You go to RS&A. We have a new system and does dynamic density optimization. The competitors look at the leaflet and say, oh my God, they're doing dynamic density optimization. We have to do that too. Yeah, we have to have dynamic density optimization. And then they go back to the labs and say, you have to implement dynamic density optimization. And then they say, what the hell is dynamic density optimization? Maybe you're talking, what might he be talking about? Are you talking about unsharp masking? Okay. Maybe there's also more to dynamic density optimization. Maybe there is a lot of company secrets also in there. Maybe this is only a nice term. Well, anyway, good. This is always nice. If you explain a method to marketing, they always come up with nice names. So it's always fun to talk to the guys in the marketing department. Good. As I promised, I will also tell you something shortly about the scatter compensation approaches, because what I've shown you so far is, yes? No. Some patients are 60 centimeters and some patients are 32 centimeters. This is dynamic. It's clearly dynamic. It's dynamic density optimization. And the density is measured with your X-ray beam. Okay, good. Now we have already seen some scatter correction approaches, but of course you may not only want to use this single software-based approach, but you may also use scatter correction approaches. And let's see a bit, go through the first part of the paper, which does the scatter correction, and maybe just for the sake of completeness, scatter correction is not just on-top masking, so you can do much more about it. And you can get much much more sophisticated methods. And in particular, in reconstruction, you won't just do on-top masking. You will use more sophisticated approaches. And in reconstruction, you have the great advantage that you're reconstructing a 3D volume anyway. So you have a hunch about what kind of density and what kind of attenuation is at every pixel, at every voxel in the volume, sorry. And therewith, you can also get an estimate of the pixel. So In 3D reconstruction, you can do more than that. And let's have a short review of the kind of methods we could do here. Okay, so generally scatter, we already talked about that. We've shown that it leads to a decrease of primary flux at the detector, and you have additive scatter flux. This is what we already shown on the board. And now let's have a look into the effect in the reconstructed image, because this is very nice. If you don't do scatter correction and you have a flat panel detector, you get reconstructions of this kind. You see this? And if you would take a profile and plot a profile, so you draw a line along here and you look at the intensities of the line. So this is plotting a profile. And what you get is, this is a typical artifact that you get from scatter. So if you were supposed to image a water cylinder, the profile through the water cylinder would look like this. It has a uniform intensity. So if you draw a line through a water cylinder, you will only have this kind of stepping function. So water cylinder present, no water cylinder, because it has the same intensity everywhere. And what you typically get if you have a scattered image, if you have scatter present, you typically are reconstructing something like this. So this is called a cupping artifact. And this is a typical artifact that you get from scatter. And usually you don't image water cylinders, so you're actually imaging patients. And here we have an example from a patient. And you see this drop in intensity inside the object. And if you do scatter correction, you can nicely correct that in the reconstruction. So you can get cupping artifacts, you can get streak noise artifacts, and if you have this kind of artifacts, it's very difficult to determine the outline of different organs in this 3D reconstruction. And if you do this correction, you get much better soft tissue contrast. Yeah? But this, now we're talking about 3D reconstruction, which means we may need more sophisticated methods than the simple convolution-based correction. And if you think about scatter reduction, one thing that if you are building the machines immediately comes to your mind is, well, why would I want to design an expensive computer-based scatter reduction method? I could just build my scanner in a way that it doesn't collect as much scatter. So you can solve that, of course, in hardware. And you can do that pre-patient, and you can do that post-patient. For pre-patient, we typically have a collimation. So let's say you are narrowing down the field of view, and this is what you typically have in CT. In CT, you have detectors that are very long, but very narrow. And one reason to do that is that you have very little scatter, because the entire scatter that goes in out-of-plane directions is not measured. So this is a very good method for scatter reduction. You start having trouble in CT when you go to larger detectors. So if you have multi-slice scanners, if you have a 320 slice scanner, then you start having trouble with scatter. If you have only a couple of slices, like four slices, then you don't have as much scatter problems. So you solve it by collimation. And then you can use beam shaping. So beam shaping is also an interesting thing. There you can reduce scatter by adding filtration. So you typically use a bow tie filter, and it has effects on scatter, and it has also effects on the dynamic range of your detector. So what you do is you try to make the attenuation across the detector uniform. And typically, so if you talk to reconstruction guys, human beings are mostly water cylinders. Yeah? So they're water cylinders or maybe water ellipses. Maybe slightly off, but most of the time water ellipses. And what can we do? Well, let's say we have the average patient and he looks like this. And this is now your CT detector. So you have a very close detector, it's very long. And you place your tube here. So maybe we place the tube even closer, because it has to fit onto the same CT gantry. So this is your CT gantry, where everything is mounted on, and it rotates around the patient. Then you have this kind of cone that is being acquired. So you're acquiring your entire object. And what you do is, well, you put something in here, and it's typically some piece of aluminum or some material that has quite some attenuation, and you shape it in the following way. So you shape it like this. Can you see that? So I shape it, I make it thick on the outside, and I make it very narrow in the towards the center. And this is approximately the shape that I'm expecting from the patient. And this yields several effects. One effect is that I have approximately the same attenuation along all the paths. And an additional effect is I have increased attenuation towards the outer parts of the image, and I have a reduced scatter by that. And this is typically used called a beam shaper or a bow tie filter. Yes?
Is this state of the art? Because I know it from radiation therapy, but for CT, you get the problem you can't apply as much dose. If you want to image fast, isn't that bad?
So in CT, you can't apply enough dose.
Yeah, so I imagine the problem could be if you want to image a pumping heart, you have
yes.
to get a lot of dose in a short
yes.
amount of time.
Yes. So if you have 4D imaging, you may need a lot of dose. Yes, this is true. But generally, in CT, you try to do low-dose scans. So you're trying to reduce the amount of dose, and this is also a kind of additional filtering. It may also help with the dose, and I think all commercially available systems in CT are shipped with bow tie filters. And in radiation therapy, you even do like active beam shaping. There you try to design a filter on the fly by moving leaflets. So they typically have collimators that then look like this. So they have bars, and you can move them back and forward, and then you can, this is a multi-leaf collimator. And with that, you can adopt your collimation such that it matches the object shape. So this is a multi-leaf collimator. And you can also do it post-patient, and one way of reducing the scatter is to move the detector to the back. So the farther I'm away with the detector, the less scatter I'm collecting. But on the other hand, as you have seen in the simulation, if I go back with the detector, I lose a lot of photons because they are absorbed in air. So this has also, so it reduces the effect of scatter, but at the same time, you lose primary. Then you can do anti-scatter grids. Anti-scatter grids are very common. So I think most detector 3D imaging detector technologies are equipped with anti-scatter grids. But remember, your anti-scatter grid has to be aligned with the source. So you can use, in this you have a fixed alignment between source and detector, so it's nice to use anti-scatter grids here. If you have a variable distance between the source and the detector, you have trouble with anti-scatter grids, because let's say I have those two source positions and this is my detector. So I need a very different orientation of my leaflets depending on the source to detector distance. So in these systems where I can move the source back and forth, I have to be careful with anti-scatter grids. You can still apply anti-scatter grids, but then you want to have a preferred distance. And of course, this also has those effects. And if you start talking about those, you can start talking for a long time. So let's not go too much into the dose effects. Yeah, all of these techniques have, of course, implications on dose and can increase or decrease dose. Good. We already talked about the collimation. This is the bowtie filter, beam shaping. We also talked about this. The air gap. We also talked about this one. This is just for completeness for your class notes. Anti-scatter grid. We talked about this, and then we can do software-based scatter compensation. And now the software-based scatter compensation, you can do it image space-based. So this is how we just had the dynamic density optimization. And of course, you can also do it, so image space means, sorry, this was wrong. So you can do it in image space, which means this is in 3D reconstruction space, like the like the 3D approach that we talked about earlier, and you can also do it in projection space. So what you start with and what you like to do in scatter correction methods is you use the concept of self-consistency. So what you will be trying to do is you have our equation that we put up here so that our measured signal is the primary signal plus the scattered signal. And then you develop some kind of method to estimate the scatter. And let's say this is, so the scatter, I'm estimating with some kind of function, and I put in the measured signal, or I put in the estimate of the primary signal. And my first estimate is, for example, the measured signal. And my first assumption is all is primary. Then I put this information into my model, and my model will give me a prediction of the scatter. So it could, for example, be our dynamic density optimization, could be this model. And I say by convolution with a large kernel, I can get a scatter estimate. And if my model is consistent, and consistent in terms of physics, it should be self-consistent. So if I do a scatter estimate with the measured data and the scatter estimate, I can do an estimate of the primary. And now I take this estimate of the primary and put it into my model again. And if my model is correct, iterating this a couple of times should give me a stable point. Because if I have a good model, and it's a predictor using the primary signal and it gives me the scattered signal, I should end up at a fixed point. And this is a fixed point iteration. So I iterate, and let's say after 5 iterations, it doesn't change anymore, and I have a self-consistent model. So the model explains the measurement by its prediction. And this is a typical scatter compensation algorithm, and this is now the 3D case, where I do first scatter compensation, then I do a reconstruction. From the reconstruction, I estimate scatter data in the projection, maybe by Monte Carlo, maybe by this kind of 3D integral approach. Then I get a scattered signal, I correct my projection data, then I reconstruct again, and I estimate again. The drawback of this approach, so this can lead to a self-consistent model, but the drawback of this approach is I need to reconstruct every iteration. So this is quite inefficient. Let's say if I need 10 iterations, I have to do 10 times the image reconstruction. Well, you can do stuff like downsampling, then you say, let's not reconstruct in the beginning at the full volume size. I know my scattered signal is low frequency. Let's go down to 64 to the power of 3 voxels. Then you can do the reconstruction much faster. Or the projection is much faster. But you still need the projection at a high resolution because you want to have the scattered signal. Or yeah, you can even do it in a kind of hierarchy. So in the first iteration, you start with a very low resolution, and then you increase resolution with the iterations to improve the computational complexity. And of course, you can also do heuristic approaches. So there's some approaches in literature that does just image processing that are not physically motivated. And according to Rührenschopf and Klingenbeck, this is only suitable for creating nice image for marketing. So this is really in the paper. And then you can also do the same thing in projection space. And in projection space, you do the reconstruction only once, and you apply a kind of scatter estimation model only in projection domain. So take the projection data, estimate the scattered data, compensate, and of course you can also iterate this. So this would be a projection space scattered, a projection space scatter correction method, and in quite a few medical products you have such a kind of correction approach because it models physics at a higher degree, and at the same time. It is computationally efficient. So you need to have your image at some point. And if you're doing reconstruction in interventional environments, you can spend at most, let's say, three minutes for the reconstruction, but maybe five, but five only. Otherwise, you can maybe spend 5 minutes on reconstruction if you have a fixed workflow. So let's say you have a kind of everything that you do in an interventional environment has to meet the doctor's workflow. So you can spend up to 5 minutes if it matches the workflow. So let's say you have a surgery and you need a 3D reconstruction of the vessels, then you give intravenous contrast agent, then the contrast agent goes up to the brain, you do your image, so you have a DSA acquisition of the head. But then in the next step, you have to move the catheter up to the brain. So this takes some time, and this gives you a time frame that you have, and within this time the reconstruction has to be done, because at the next step you will need the reconstruction. So the time requirements that you have are extremely dependent on workflow, and typically you do not want to change the clinical workflow. So if you, let's say you work on some scientific project and you go to the clinic, they won't like it to change anything in their procedure, because they do many of these procedures, and this would mean that they have to alter their workflow, and this can affect them quite significantly. And if you say, oh, we just need more 3D image at this point and one more reconstruction, but it takes 3 minutes to do the reconstruction and they have to wait in the surgery room for your reconstruction to be done until they can continue, they will say it's not acceptable. We cannot just sit there and wait for 3 minutes until we have the result. So everything you do needs to match the clinical workflow, and every time you start developing some kind of aid, you need to make sure that you actually understand how the kind of intervention works and at what points you can spend more time and less time and how you can get into that workflow. This is very important. If you have no idea what's going on in the clinic, you better cross-check with the clinic, and you can just, so most of the time with engineers, they're quite open. If you're working in such a research project, so not if you're just say, okay, I'm a tourist and I want to see some surgeries, they won't like that. But if you're really integrated and you want to work with them, it's usually not a big problem to actually get into the surgery room. Of course, you can't interfere. So you can't be a burden to them, but usually in these scientific projects, there you can actually go to the ER and witness the actual surgery, and you will develop much better software if you know what kind of computers are there, what kind of equipment is in the room, and if you have an understanding of the actual problem that they are having in the interventional suite. Good. So this is the scatter compensation method for the projection space. Okay. Yeah, and you do these fixed point iterations. We already talked about that. You can also do some statistical approaches, but let's not go into too much details. So this was more or less the summary how you would do that if your aim is 3D reconstruction. So in 3D reconstruction, you cannot just work with this kind of unsharp masking. You need a more sophisticated scatter model. Okay, so what you would do is you would you design your model, your scatter model, you decide for a model, then you need to find out how to determine the parameters of your model, and then you need to validate that. And of course, the main figure of merit that you do in medical image processing is how well can your task be performed with your kind of processing. So even if you do simplifications, it may be okay because you can still get the effect that you wanted. So you wanted to have an improved display of small lesions that have a particular contrast. So if this is your task here on the right side, then this particular model may be suitable. If you have a different task, you may need a very different algorithm. And this is what we want to get at in this class, that you learn how to adopt your algorithms and how to select the complexity algorithm driven by your task. And I think this brings me to the conclusion of today's class. Do you have any questions so far? No questions? No questions? Very well. Then we will meet again next Thursday. Yeah, so no lecture on Tuesday. We meet again next Thursday, so in 1 week. And then we will continue with edge detection, and we will talk about structured tensors. We talk a bit about convolution, and we may talk a bit about Wesselness. Okay? See you next week.